outside. And all them crazy murderers will never run from inside. You try to keep me down cause you see not joy. All them knows them from, so you call a man a boy. I ain't a tyke and shall see, hoping up your eyes.
The thing that makes Judaism dangerous to everybody, to every race, to every nation, to every idea, is that we smash things that aren't true. We don't believe in the boundaries of nation state. We don't believe in the ideas of these individual gods that protect individual groups of people. These are all artificial constructions, and Judaism really teaches us how to see that. In a sense, our detractors have us right in that we are a corrosive force. We're breaking down the false gods of all nations and all people because they're not real.
And here we go, folks. It is Wednesday, January the 6th, 2021. And you are listening to today's early morning edition of The Ugly Truth. Welcome to the program. Folks, actually, it's not that early. Early for me, in the sense, because I have been up for a good 4 or 5 hours reading news. As we speak right now, as we go to tape, President Trump is speaking in the nation's capital. And he is addressing the very large crowd of supporters there who have gathered in order to show their support for him on the day where the Congress is set to determine who is going to be President of the United States. Now, I'll admit, folks, it is a bit unnerving watching all of this take place. I've gotten a few emails from folks asking me what my predictions are, and I generally tend to err on the side of the good advice of Mike Piper, who told me years ago, he said, be very careful about making predictions because you could make 100 predictions, 99 of which turn out to be accurate. It's the one that's going to get you. It's the one that doesn't even have to be completely wrong. If it's just only off by a couple of degrees when it finally pans out, then they'll hang it around your neck as an anchor and they'll throw you into the ocean with it. Well, nevertheless, folks, I do render my own predictions on things once in a while. And I actually don't even call them predictions, folks. I couch the discussion by saying I tend to think that blah, blah, blah. And I have, as I said, I've gotten a few emails from people saying, well, what do you think? What do you think is going to happen? And as of this moment, folks, despite everything that we see taking place in front of us right now, I'll just give you the answer that I've given on a few occasions that I've been asked. As of this moment, despite all of the criteria that tends to go in the opposite direction, I still believe, not with a great degree of certainty, I would say, borrowing that old phrase that I utilized many, many times on previous programs, I'm 51 to 49% in favor, meaning it's just a hair's difference, folks, okay? I'm not going to say 75%, or I'll say 51 to 49. And, of course, I have to say this because I don't know, what the other side is planning to do. I know what they would like to do if they were able to, but I also know that Trump is very smart and that he has probably put all of their plans into his calculus and has got some type of countermeasures of his own ready to go. Anyway, I would say at this point, folks, even today, with as dire as everything appears, I still maintain, again, only at 51 to 49%, that on January the 20th, okay, Inauguration Day, Trump is going to be sitting in the White House. Now, whether he is there because this case has been adjudicated by a court, or whether he is there because Mike Pence has utilized what some say and what others deny are his legal rights as president of the Senate, to wield his own discernment in casting away votes that are questionable, whether it's been adjudicated or whether it is because of, you know, what we have been hearing now for the last couple of weeks involving Pence, or whether Trump is there because the system has just completely collapsed, and there simply isn't any practical means for removing the driver from the driving from the seat and replacing him with a new driver. I still say that on January the 20th, Trump's going to be sitting in the White House. He made a statement, I think it was yesterday, it was sometime this week. He said, "I'm going to fight like hell, and there's no way we're going to let these people take over the White House." Now, you know, as we have talked about really for the last 5 years, folks, ever since Trump walked onto the scene, his entire decision to do this, as we have theorized, this wasn't just him, but he is the product of something much bigger than simply Donald J. Trump. That he has got powerful people behind him, people in the military, people, you know, that we might call the white hats within the intelligence community, people in finance, yes, even finance, Wall Street, who understand just how close to the edge of the cliff we are, and that all that it would take would be just a slight gust of wind to knock us as a country over the edge. And, you know, I've used this analogy in the past, and I'm going to apologize because I know at least one of our listeners, he sits down with his daughters, and I was horrified to hear that this was the case, his young daughters, especially after last week's program, and when I said that I used a certain very delicate comparison to describe how much of a no-brainer a lot of this stuff is. Nevertheless, I'm going to advise my friend here and any other responsible parents who go to great lengths in order to protect and defend and preserve the innocence of their children to maybe cover their ears. You know, the imagery I've used in the past in describing what we have witnessed now with the emergence of Trump as president is that it's, you know, America has been compared to a prostitute, and I would say rightly so for many, many years, and particularly a prostitute to organized Jewish interests, and especially a prostitute to Israel. And, of course, we know that prostitutes, you know, they engage in very immoral and degrading and at times unsanitary behavior in order to earn their daily bread. And in order to do this, they are willing to engage in every type of immoral and degrading and, you know, just unsavory acts, you know, in order to please their customer, okay, who's paying them to do it. But the one thing that you will never be able to get a prostitute to willingly do, no matter how much money you offer to pay her or him, is to put a loaded gun in their mouth and pull the trigger. Okay, at that point, the tricks stop. Okay, all of the other stuff that involved whips and chains and maybe household pets and objects, you know, that shouldn't be inserted into the human anatomy, okay, at that point where, you know, the escalation of degrading behavior gets to the point where he or she is being told by their customer to put a loaded gun in their mouth and pull the trigger, that's where it stops. That's where they draw the line. And I do believe that that is the best way of describing the emergence of Donald J. Trump as president. He understands, he and the people behind him understand that we have reached this point where there isn't any more give. Now we're being told to put a loaded gun in our mouth and pull the trigger. And please don't misunderstand me, folks. I'm not comparing Donald Trump to a prostitute. I'm just using this to describe what has been, you know, a very immoral and unfaithful political system. You know, the United States has been in bed with some very, very unsavory people for a long time. Now, I'll leave that for the later historians and maybe even the theologians to decide whether or not these immoral rendezvous were in the nation's interest or not. I know politics can be very nasty business, and sometimes, as Benjamin Franklin said, sometimes when you find yourself in a very low place, you have to stoop. Nevertheless, Trump's statement that he's going to fight like hell and that he's not going to allow these people to take over the White House, you know, Trump has always been very, very careful about the language that he uses. You know, the fact that he has tweeted things, he has said things that have had all sorts of very layered and nuanced meaning to them. So, you know, and this is, I think, one of the mistakes that a lot of people make. They think that Trump is just full of bluster and that he's not particularly intelligent. And I completely disagree, folks. Completely disagree. I think he's highly, highly intelligent. Very well read, very well educated. You don't operate in the kind of world in which he has operated throughout his entire adult life and amassed the kinds of wealth and success as he has without, as a Gentile, keep that in mind, without developing some pretty sharp intellectual skills. So the way that I read this, when he says he's going to fight like hell and that there's no way he is going to allow these people to take over the White House, I think what he's indicating at that point is that he intends to use all of the power at his disposal in order to make sure that this bomb does not go off in the United States. And of course, what I'm talking about here is Joe Biden and Israel taking control of American foreign and domestic policy again. Because that is exactly what happened, folks. When Donald Trump was elected, American foreign policy was put into the hands of an American nationalist. Now, a lot of very one-dimensional people who really don't, you know, they try their hand at political chess when they're barely competent at political checkers. Okay, they point to very superficial things, such as Trump's quote unquote Jewish daughter and his Jewish son-in-law, and all of the nice things he said about Israel, and of course all of the gestures that he's made as president that have appeared to be very favorable towards the Jewish state, without considering that there was another layer, another very nuanced layer attached to this altogether. You know, and I have always tried to explain this strategy on the part of Trump as the art of the deal, right? That's the name of his book, his best-selling book, The Art of the Deal. And Trump's posture, his strategy in all of these things he's done, particularly with regards to Israel, is that he gives five in order to get back six or seven or eight or more. So, you know, when you actually look at the things that Trump has done with regards to foreign policy, and especially with regards to American foreign policy in the Middle East, and especially with regards to Israel and this peace deal that he has been pushing for, when you really understand to the full extent necessary exactly what it is that the Jews mean to achieve in the Middle East, you will understand in a millimicrosecond that they are not happy with Trump's peace deal at all. Okay. Despite all of the political theatrics that Netanyahu and, you know, the Jewish lobby in America and in certain parts of Israel, in which they have engaged, you know, clapping and smiling and all of the rest of this stuff, they are furious. They are fuming that an American president finally came along and came up with something that stands a very good chance of working. The previous presidents, they all stuck to the same old model which we've described, which we've discussed on this program here before, which was the various UN resolutions that would have forced Israel to go back to the pre-1967 lines, 1967. Of course, being the year that that the Jews stole, that basically doubled the size of their territory by stealing Gaza and the West Bank and the Golan Heights. And all of these previous presidents that went down this road of trying to contain this virus in the Middle East, that they all did this based upon the, you know, adhering to these UN resolutions that would have forced Israel to give this land up. Well, Trump and his people figured out that that has been the component that has blown up all of these other peace deals and has led to the end of these various presidential administrations. Okay. Because it's true, you know, the Jews are not necessarily a monolithic entity. You know, they're historically famous for fighting and squabbling and arguing. And especially with regards to American versus Israeli Jews. You know, American Jews tend to be very liberal on social issues and not particularly enamored with any kind of religion, okay? But all of those differences disappear once a president starts talking about forcing Israel to give up land that she stole in 67. Then those left-wingers who make the pretenses of hating their right-wing counterparts in Israel, and especially Netanyahu, all of a sudden, they are found to be very simpatico with Israel's well-being. Okay, and they'll work against a Democratic president, even as they did with Carter, as they did with Bill Clinton, as they did with, when Al Gore was running against George W. Bush. And so Trump has figured out exactly, you know, where all of the, you know, just like they had to, in order to bring down the Twin Towers, they had to spend a lot of time going in and studying all of the structural points in that building where explosive charges had to be put in order to bring this thing down in the dramatic fashion that they needed in order to get this war fever started within the American people. Likewise, Trump and his people spent a lot of time studying the various peace deals that blew up in the past and made sure to avoid those points altogether. So anyway, let's see, I know I'm kind of wandering off topic here, folks. So with regards to what we see taking place today, okay, as I said, I still think at this point on January the 20th, Trump is still going to be there in the White House. I think that it is somewhere between entirely possible and entirely probable, okay, that we could see Joe Biden and half or more of Congress hauled out of their homes in the middle of the night by the FBI, federal marshals, whoever, in handcuffs and charged with all kinds of crimes, not the least of which is treason, which the president himself referenced in a tweet that he had put out a few months ago, where he said Nancy Pelosi and all of those in Congress who colluded with her were guilty of treason. Now, treason, of course, is the only crime specified in the, at least the original U.S. Constitution. And it is defined as giving aid and comfort to America's enemies. Now, again, a lot of people think that this is Trump being hyperbolic or him engaging in political theatrics or whatever, but I don't think that it's that at all. I think that he and his team of deep staters, and yes, folks, there are people working with him who were part of that deep state for many, many years. People who were, you know, who played an integral part in you know, all of the dirty tricks that the United States has engaged in around the world for decades. But who, just like our prostitute, our theoretical prostitute, hypothetical prostitute we discussed earlier, who have come to the point where they realize now that the vultures have come home to roost, okay? And now it's America's turn. And so for in the interest of protecting themselves and protecting their own investment in this empire, you know, they have switched from being the black hats to the white hats. This doesn't mean that they're good people, doesn't mean necessarily that they have the overall best interests of the country in mind, even though I think many of them do. It means that they're acting in their own self-interest. Okay. You know, this is for whatever reason, for reasons which I don't entirely understand yet, and which I really can only explain by just with one simple description, which is that it just requires too much mental energy for them to process. For whatever reason, there are people who just simply do not understand this particular phenomenon, that powerful people will act in their own interests. And even if that requires that they turn 180 degrees in the opposite direction from which they have been going for a long time. So again, folks, I realize this has been kind of an extended introduction. We're already 20 minutes into the program, and I do have some important things that I want to cover with you all. Let's see. Trying to think. Okay, well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. We are going to play a little soundbite here, and this was President Trump's address to the nation on New Year's, where he was wishing the American people a happy New Year's, and he was listing off the various accomplishments that he and his administration have made, and he. The one that he seemed to spend the most time on, and the one that obviously was I think he wanted this particular accomplishment to be the thing that people walked away from remembering the most, even though it involved, it wasn't increasing our industrial output, it wasn't dealing with immigration. It was dealing with events on the other side of the world, and of course it was that issue dealing with the Middle East, which we are going to listen to right now.
We have secured our borders and paused immigration to protect American workers. We lowered drug prices for the first time in 51 years, and after years of endless foreign wars, we are signing historic peace deals in the Middle East. It's all ending in the Middle East. We have to hope it keeps going. It's so easy if you know what you're doing. In this season of joy, Americans have so much to be grateful for. We're all blessed to live in the greatest country ever to exist on the face of the earth, and we have made it greater than ever before. As long as we remain loyal to our nation, devoted to our citizens, and faithful to Almighty God, we know that the best is yet to come. God bless you, and God bless America.
And there you go, folks. That was Donald J. Trump, President of the United States, wishing the American people a Happy New Year's and listing off the various accomplishments which he has authored. And he made sure to spend what I think was, maybe I'm reading more into it than is warranted, but what I thought was a great deal of focus, that he really wanted people to understand this. And when he said, it is all ending in the Middle East. Now, again, folks, you know, this is one of my things. It's either a curse or a blessing or both. I don't know which one it is. A good friend of mine says that, that I've been blessed with this, but I tell you, even though it tends to make life, especially when you're studying politics, more interesting, it definitely does not make it any easier. When you are micro-focusing on certain words and turns of phrase in order to get a bigger picture of what's going on, my friend says that I'm gifted in that regard, but I don't know. when he says it's all ending in the Middle East. Okay. Now, of course, you know, we have to look at what prefaces this. I think that's the right word, prefaces. What comes before it is he's talking about these endless wars. Okay. Now, the average one-dimensional person, and I'm not speaking disparagingly of them, the average person who looks at it only in a one-dimensional manner, let's put it that way. The one person who looks at this in merely a one-dimensional manner will say, oh, well, he's just talking about, you know, the wars that we have gotten into, you know, since 9/11, okay? And how, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, all of this stuff. But it's actually much bigger. You know, when you're talking about never-ending wars, okay, these wars began long before America got involved in 9/11. Okay, these endless wars that Trump is really talking about are the wars that began, if we want to use it as an historical document, the wars that began the moment that the Jews or the Hebrews or the Israelites or whatever word we want to give to these people, the moment that they, following the directions of their father Abraham, who claimed to have heard voices in his head telling him to go and to seize the land, okay, that was promised to him and to his descendants. That's the moment that these never-ending wars began, folks. They didn't just begin 20 years ago with the little monkey George W. Bush, the little monkey in the White House at that time. And it didn't begin 30 years ago with the gorilla, the big gorilla, father of the little monkey in the White House, George H.W. Bush, who launched the initial wars, you know, really initially where the United States first found itself embroiled in a major, major conflict in that part of the world. These never-ending wars have been going on ever since the Hebrews, the Israelites, the Jews, the Chosenites, the Chosenoids, whatever we want to call them, from the moment that they first got the idea into their heads that this land was given to them and that they were given carte blanche, or maybe carte rouge, okay, to inflict whatever kinds of violence was necessary in order to get that land for themselves. So yes, folks, I believe that Donald Trump, in that statement, when he talks about it all coming to an end, he's not saying that American involvement in the Middle East is all coming to an end. He said it's all coming to an end in the Middle East. And what he's talking about is building a cage around this wild animal known as Israel, and not allowing her to go forward with these insane plans that she has entertained for thousands of years. Thousands of years. Because he knows, folks, he knows how it is all going to end up. Now, this is very important, folks, because you can rest assured, everybody can rest assured, that Benjamin Netanyahu and all of the other powerful individuals and groups working in the service of Judea Incorporated, and especially the neocons in America, Bill Kristol, Jennifer Rubin, Max Boot, Elliot Cohen, David Froom, all of them, they understand exactly what Trump means when he says it's all coming to an end in the Middle East. They understand that not only has America, at least that part of America that is in league and in tune with Trump's foreign policy objectives, but you know, but the country as a whole, that they have come to the point where they are not interested in fighting these wars for Zion any further. Okay. They understand that, but they also understand the deeper implications of what Trump is saying. it's all coming to an end in the Middle East. So this, folks, again, at the risk of, you know, saying this for the 10,000th time, this is the reason that we find ourselves, all of us right now, all of us. I dare say there isn't a person listening to this program right now whose life has not been turned upside down by the events, particularly of the last year, but also really for the last 5 years, ever since Trump announced that he was seeking the presidency. There isn't a person listening to this who is not affected by this, by Trump's decision to bring it all to an end. That is the nucleus around which this entire operation to get rid of him revolves. Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, they don't care about immigration. That is way down at the bottom of the list of their concerns. They don't care about the Second Amendment, way down at the bottom of the list. They don't care about Black Lives Matter or police brutality. They don't care about any of those things. All they care about is seeing what they believe to be the historical destiny that was bequeathed upon them by their vicious and violent and vindictive God in creating this theocratic empire. You know, this is just an amazing thing. And you know, I'll get to that later. I'll use that later. I always come into these programs, you know, with a million things on my mind that I want to discuss, and then as soon as I start yapping, I forget about 99% of it. Well, I'll tell you what we're going to do, folks. We are going to listen to another soundbite. Now, this is a little bit, it's not too long. I think it's less than 10 minutes, but it's a YouTube video. It's a very good one, and it's something that we have talked about, as I said, for the last 5 years, that if you don't understand the big target here, okay, the big target with regards to the recreation, this Frankenstein monster known as the Jewish state, that was dug up from its grave and, you know, brought back to life. If you don't understand the bigger plans that they have, the apocalyptic plans, we have a hard time as Gentiles getting into the mind of a crazy person, okay? I think we talked about this on the last program, that crazy people, they do live in a world all their own, especially people who are schizophrenic, people who are led by the voices that they think they hear in their head. You know, there was a very funny skit years and years ago, I'm thinking 35 years at least. David Letterman, the late night talk show host, he had this gig where he would send his camera crew out into the streets of New York and to talk to people and, you know, get some pretty interesting, funny material. Well, anyway, he had one set up one night. They wanted to have a little experiment to see who would get kicked out of this fancy restaurant the quickest, okay? And so it really is funny. So they had two subjects. One of them was this little old man, and he had like 10 or 15 of these little toy dogs on leashes, and he was walking them, these dogs. Of course, whoever this guy is, it may have been the one guy that Letterman had on his show, that old man, short little man. I can't remember his name. But anyway, so he had like 10 or 15 of these little toy dogs on leashes, and he was walking them. So you can imagine, you know, how many with all these dogs. And the other guy that they had, the other test, you know, subject, was this guy walking around with no shirt, no shoes, barefoot, and just a pair of jeans. Now, what made this particularly funny was that it was about 20 degrees below zero that night. Okay, so they had the camera set up outside the restaurant, and then as soon as the door opened, they would start the stopwatch. And then as soon as the door opened again and the person was leaving because they had been told they had to leave, and then they compared the two. Well, the one who got kicked out the fastest wasn't the old man with the dogs. It was the guy with who was only wearing a pair of jeans, and it was like 20 degrees below zero. Barefoot, no shirt. And the reason why they obviously kicked him out fastest is because only a crazy person would be out walking around the streets of New York City with no shoes on and no shirt, and it's 20 degrees below zero. He's either crazy or he's whacked out on drugs. Whatever the case may be, it's much worse for business for this fancy restaurant to have this crazy person come in than the old man with the 10 or 15 dogs. Anyway, I realize that was a bit of a digression, but actually there's a lot of truth to be gleaned from that about crazy people and how they at least should be dealt with. Okay. Well, this is what we're dealing with when we're dealing with the followers of Judaism, the corrosive force, right? That's the description that precedes the program, is this interview with this insane Jew, Douglas Rushkoff, where he's talking about Judaism and how dangerous it is to everyone. You know, and notice, folks, he doesn't say Zionism, he doesn't say Talmudism, he says Judaism, okay, as a religion. And, you know, he doesn't say that it is challenging to everyone. He says it's dangerous to everyone, to all nations, to all peoples, because the Jews, by virtue of their Judaism, they tear down things, destroy things, which they believe to be not true. All nations, all peoples, that's what he says. And he's absolutely right. He's absolutely right. And this is the fatal mistake that mankind has made in not dealing with this thing on the level on which it should have been dealt with, which is that this is craziness, this is crazy talk. Okay, which is fine if you're dealing with somebody whose insanity has incapacitated them to the point where they're not able to get control of a nation's money supply. They have not been able to get control of a nation's informational system, meaning the media. If these people are so incapacitated by their delusions and their mental illness that they are not able to chew their way into the political system of the nation or whatever, okay? But this is clearly not the case. These people are driven by this delusion, but at the same time, they are very gifted, I would say diabolically gifted, as we've talked about on previous programs, that they, yes, they're crazy, but they are driven by something that far surpasses the delusions that drive other people, that basically incapacitates them. Anyway, we're going to listen to a very interesting soundbite here, folks. And the person who's doing this is he is of the Hebraic persuasion. He's got a YouTube channel. I recommend that you go and watch these YouTube videos, folks, because they're very interesting. And it really does give us a much better understanding of the peculiar electrical current that drives these people in their thinking. This particular video that he put together describes what happened with Rome and Judea. And even though he doesn't come out and say it, he doesn't come out and say that everything that we're witnessing right now is basically the historical rebounding of what took place 2,000 years ago, I think that after you listen to what he has to say, that you will see, you know, you will come to this conclusion all by yourself when you compare what he is describing here with everything that we see taking place right now, including all of the political instability that we see here in America, that you will see, you will be able to make that correlation in a New York minute. So let's just sit down and listen to this.
The Roman-Jewish War essentially ended with the destruction of the Temple, which demonstrated the futility of the immediate messianic hopes of the Jews in the region. However, fighting continued for a few more years, either to the year 73 or possibly 74 of the Common Era. There are a few holdout fortresses of Jews outside of Jerusalem, and the most significant of those was undoubtedly Masada, which is shown here. It's a dramatic cliff-top fortress. It was actually the palace of Herod at one point, his vacation palace, and it's in a very forbidding part of the Judean desert, and it is essentially impregnable. The only way to really attack Masada is to climb its faces, which are quite steep, at least on two sides of it, and very, very difficult to actually breach its defenses. The rebels under Elazar ben Yair had actually laid in a tremendous amount of supplies, so they could actually last there for many years. Nevertheless, the Romans were brilliant and dogged engineers. They ended up climbing the mountain, and they built a siege tower that was about 80 meters or 260 feet high to be able to breach the final wall. When they got to the very last barrier, which was made of wood, and they set it on fire, the rebels located within the compound realized that there was no way they could keep the Roman soldiers out. And so in a very dramatic act, almost 1,000 rebels, and we're talking here about families, not just soldiers, but men, women, and children, committed mass suicide overnight rather than have themselves be turned over as slaves to the Romans. A very dramatic moment in Jewish history, a complex moment that has reverberations in modern Israeli ideology as well. And hopefully we'll come back to that when we get towards the end of the series. The Romans enacted significant punishment on the remaining population. And we will go into this in greater detail as we talk about the diaspora and moving forward. But for now, let's just look at a few examples of it. Symbolically, we see the institution of the Judaea Capta coins. The Romans actually printed quite a few examples of this coin. On the left, they usually have a portrait of Vespasian. You can see him wearing the laurel wreath of victory around his head. And on the right, there is a Roman soldier standing by a balsam pine, which was one of the most important exports of Israel at the time. And there is a forlorn woman with her head in her hand, and she is representing the Judean people. So Judaea Capta means Judea is taken captive. And this was a form of propaganda. You know, coins are like messages that circulate everywhere and people see them and it means something. It was a very important way of advertising state power. Just to show you a couple of examples of this Judaea coin, sometimes the Roman soldier is portrayed as being, you know, way out of proportion, large compared to the woman to show the dominance of Rome. And in some especially chilling cases, she's actually shown with her hands bound behind her back as a slave to be taken away into captivity. The Romans also celebrated this in Rome proper with the erection of the Arch of Titus. You see it here. And inside the arch, when we zoom in a little bit, there is a depiction of the Romans taking away spoils from the temple. Here's a better resolution look at it. You can see that they're clearly holding the candelabra called the menorah, which would have stood in the Temple Mount area. A scholar at Yeshiva University did some chemical analysis of the sculpture and actually was able to reconstruct how it would have looked to the Romans in the ancient period, because they actually preferred their sculptures to be painted. So it would have looked like this to Romans. You can see on the left, there's a sign that says Leges Judaeorum, or the Law of the Jews. Perhaps that was referring to the tablets of the law, or maybe a Torah scroll. You can see they're clearly carrying the menorah. The sign next to it says Candelabrum Judaeorum, the Jewish candelabra. And on the right, they have the Sacra Judaeorum, the holy thing of the Jews, which appears to be the Shulchan with the altar with the Badim, the staves that would be used to carry it, perhaps. The Romans also imposed some terrible taxes and some restrictions on Jewish activity, which I'd like to explore in a later lecture. But there is a saving moment in all of this. One thing that we have glossed over is the reaction of the Pharisees, in particular, a rabbi named Yochanan ben Zakkai, who saw early on that the revolt against Rome was doomed to failure. And in a rather dramatic moment, he had himself smuggled out of Jerusalem to actually meet with Vespasian directly. This is one of the details that the Talmud offers. And he makes a request of Vespasian, actually three requests. But the one that's especially significant for us is he says to Vespasian, in Hebrew, we have the phrase, Tein li Yavne v'chachameha. Give me the city of Yavne, Yamnia in Greek, and its sages, which meant that he wanted to have a safe base where the pacifistic Pharisees could retreat and could continue to engage in religious study. This ultimately was the seed from which future Jewish leadership would grow, and the future of the Jewish people would be preserved through these scholars studying the traditional values and texts of Judaism.
Okay, folks, there you go. That was Dr. Henry Abramson. And as you can tell by his name, he is definitely of the Hebraic pedigree. And please, no emails from know-it-alls, trying to school me on the difference between the Hebrews and the Israelites and the Judites and the Judeans and the Jews and all the rest of that stuff. I've already discussed this on many occasions. It simply doesn't matter. Okay, a rose by any other name is still a rose, and a Hebrew, Israelite, Judean, Judite, Jew, Khazarite, whatever you want to call them, is still what they are by virtue of the Judaism which they practice. Anyway, very interesting little thing, and I encourage you folks to subscribe, or at least to get on YouTube and to watch his videos, because he's very, very interesting. He obviously knows his material very well. And as I've said on this program many times, he is considered an impeccable source as a primary source of information. It's one thing to read an article, say, on my website or on a website, put out by somebody else, of the Gentile persuasion. But when you're hearing it from the mouth of Judea itself, then that is an entirely different thing. Now, I want to go over very quickly some of the things that he says in his presentation that are of vital importance for us to understand and plug into the equation here if we're going to get an accurate picture of what we are looking at. Number one, he says that the destruction of the temple, and this is on the part of the Romans, folks, because it happened twice. First by the Babylonians, which obviously that is modern-day Iraq. Boy, isn't that a coincidence. Right after 9/11, Iraq is the first country that is destroyed. He says that the destruction of the temple ended the immediate messianic hope for the region. Now, this is very important, very important in a geopolitical sense. Okay. First of all, what he's talking about is what plans were afoot at the time when the Romans destroyed the temple. And this is 70 AD that we're talking about. Okay. There was this expectation that the Jewish Messiah, the Moshiach, whatever we want to call him, that the Jews at the time, before the Romans had gotten there, and certainly before they had the Romans had destroyed their temple, that they were actively engaged in preparing the world for the arrival of their Messiah. Now, this is important for us to understand, and especially the history that happened before this. Okay, before the Jews found themselves at war with the Romans, they found themselves at war with the Greeks. Alexander the Great, as we know, he was the first Western conqueror to go into the region and to impose Western values on the people there. Actually, he didn't. The Greeks didn't impose. They were very tolerant of most cultures and most religious practices of the people. But nevertheless, they brought, you know, what really was Greek enlightenment and a relaxed lifestyle. And you have to remember that the Jews, by virtue of their Judaism, that they adhere to these very, very, very strict life and death rules, as we've discussed on this program many times. You know, just a few of which include stoning to death somebody who goes out and picks up sticks on the Sabbath in order to build a fire in his cave or his hut or whatever, in order to heat the place and to cook his food. Stoned to death for picking up sticks. We can all imagine, folks, if there were some passage in the Quran, the book, the holy book of Islam, saying that a person, if they went out and picked up sticks on a certain day of the week, that they were to be taken out and stoned to death, we wouldn't hear the end of it. But here, in this case, okay, because it's the religion of the Jews, because it's the Old Testament, it doesn't get any mention, any notice whatsoever. Anyway, there was this, and as we've discussed on previous programs recently, this celebration of Hanukkah, or as our dearly departed, greatly missed friend Mike Piper used to call it, Hanukkah, where the Jews every year, right around Christmas time, they celebrate, you know, with the menorah and all the rest of that. What people don't realize, you know, of course, they're sold the bill of goods, that Hanukkah is just the celebration of lights, and they make donuts and all kinds of other stuff. But it isn't that at all, folks. It is a celebration of what was a massacre of innocent people, okay? Jews who, for completely understandable reasons, began abandoning their Judaism in favor of the relaxed lifestyle of the Greeks, okay? Instead of the 613 lashes of Moses that is part of a Jew's life, the 613 rules found in the Torah, including stoning to death people who pick up sticks on the Sabbath, you know, these Jews who became Greek in their lifestyle, Hellenized Jews, they were the first ones who were hunted down and slaughtered, okay? Had their heads chopped off. They actually found a place in Israel that had been excavated by archaeologists where they're pretty sure it was a head chopping place where Jews who were guilty of apostasy, of abandoning their Judaism in favor of the more relaxed lifestyle of the Greeks, had their heads chopped off. Just like ISIS, okay? I mean, this is what we were told, is that, isn't it horrible? Which, of course, it was. ISIS, you know, this wild animal that was set loose by American and Israeli intelligence services in order to go throughout the countryside and to terrorize people and to cut their heads off. You know, we've seen the videos of that. Well, guess where they got, guess where, you know, the template, the prototype for that was. It was with the Maccabees, which they celebrate at Hanukkah. Anyway, after this period, this is very important, folks, for several reasons, not just related to this speech by by Dr. Abramson. After the Maccabees had instituted their reign of terror, okay, you know, hunting down apostate Jews who had fallen from their faith and either killing them or forcing them to come back. They would take little boys who had not been circumcised. This was one of the things that the Greeks obviously didn't like, was this practice of circumcision. After they were finished in that, and then they instituted this government known as the Hasmonean dynasty. Okay, the Hasmoneans were a family, a Jewish family, and they ruled Israel for many years. And one of the first things that they did upon securing their political power was they began expanding outward. Began expanding outward and started stealing as much of the land as they could and forcibly converting the peoples that they had conquered to Judaism. So, when the Romans came in, there was a political squabble that took place within the Hasmonean family over who was going to succeed to the throne. They started trying to curry favor. Each side started trying to curry favor with the Romans. Because, you know, everybody needs a big friend, okay, if they find themselves in the middle of an inner city gang war, okay. This is how the Romans made their way into the region, is that they were asked to come in by both sides, hoping, and of course what the Jews were planning to do was they were going to use the Romans to get on top of one or the other. And then they figured they would boot the Romans out, that they would, you know, God had blessed their plans, you know, for creating this empire, and he would give them the power to defeat what was the most powerful empire in the world at that time. So, obviously, this is not what took place at all, and the result of it was that the Romans solidified their control there, and the Jews, you know, they never got over the fact that they lost control of their country after this reign of terror under the Maccabees. And so this is where the beginnings of this war started. In many ways, the war against the Romans was just a continuation of the Maccabean war against the Greeks. Okay? Now, this is important too, folks, because when we look at the modern-day creation, the creation of modern-day Israel, they are very, they're very plain, very matter of fact in stating that they are the modern day continuation of the Maccabean model. In fact, Israel's national symbol is the symbol of the menorah, okay, which was, of course, this features in the lore of, you know, the Maccabean victory over the Greeks and over Western civilization and all of the rest of that. That's what the menorah is there for. And that's why Israel chose the menorah as its national symbol, because they see the modern day recreation of this monster to be the great, great, great grandchildren of the ancient Maccabees. Okay. And with that, and this is very important, folks, for us to understand in plugging all of this into our comprehension of what is going on right now politically. As I said, the Maccabees began the process of stealing all of, beginning that process of creating this greater Israel, this Nile to the Euphrates thing. Okay? This happened under the Maccabees. And it was stopped by the Romans. When the Romans came in, one of the first things that Pompey did, Pompey the Great, one of the first things that he did is he started giving back the lands that had been stolen by the Maccabees. And basically caging in these insane religious nutcases to a much smaller piece of land, at least the piece of land that they owned prior to the whole Maccabean uprising. So Israel, seeing herself today as the modern-day equivalent, resurrection or whatever we want to call it, of the Maccabees, means that they plan to do what their ancestors did, which is to swallow up all of this land that they believe was promised to them by their violent, vindictive God, Yahweh. Everything from the Nile to the Euphrates. And by the way, folks, I'm just going to digress here for just a second, because I know if I don't do it now, I will forget about it. Doing some research on the website, I ran into a couple of articles that... hold on just a second here. A couple of articles that I published years ago. Let's see. Sorry, folks. I should have gotten all this ready ahead of time. I apologize. I don't claim to be a I don't claim to be a professional here, folks. You know, Mike Piper always referred to himself as a hack writer with strong opinions. And I kind of feel the same way. And the proof of that, obviously, is the fact that I don't have these articles pulled up. Anyway, the article that I'm looking for, I think it's, oh yeah, that's a good one to bring up. Maybe we'll do it on the next program. Let's see. Okay. So there's a story that I found the other day. I published this years ago, and it was an open letter. Doggone it! It's not it. Hold on. It's an open letter from this rabbi. I'm not even going to try to pull it up any longer, folks. It's taking too long. We're already at an hour here for today's program. This was an open letter written by this insane rabbi. I know I'm repeating myself when I say that, because a person can't be a rabbi and not be insane. It was an open letter written 2 years ago, 2018. It was an open letter to Donald Trump. And he said that at this time we were dealing here in the United States with all sorts of, you know, weather phenomenon. We had wildfires out west. We had hurricanes on the East Coast. But things that have been going on since the beginning of time. But, you know, you can always count on the Jews and their supporters. Every little thing that comes along, okay, it's a sign from God, and it's all connected to the well-being of the Jews. Anyway, this letter that he wrote to Trump, an open letter, he said, you know, that that America is going through these plagues. Very important terminology he used, of course, folks, because that obviously harkens back to the book of Exodus in the Old Testament, the Torah, where the mean old Egyptian Pharaoh, you know, because he's mistreating the apple of God's eye, Egypt is falling into all of these horrible plagues because he won't let Yahweh's people go to the home, to the Holy Land, to the Promised Land. So, so the rabbi is comparing all of these natural disasters to the same plagues that existed in Egypt, and he compares Trump to the Pharaoh. And all of this is related to Trump's plans for frustrating the God of Israel's plans with regards to the Middle East. And this rabbi, in his piece, in his open letter to Trump, he states very, very plainly, folks, he said, God's plan is for a Jewish state from the Nile in the south to the Euphrates in the north. And anything that comes along that threatens God's word, God's plans in that regard, is going to result in apocalyptic punishments. Okay. And, of course, what he's talking about at that time, remember this is 2 years before coronavirus, is the wildfires out west and the hurricanes on the East Coast and all the rest of that. But he does say very clearly in it, you know, that there are worse things to come. Worse things to come. Well, the obvious reason for the importance of this statement is because, you know, we find ourselves now in the middle of a literal plague known as coronavirus. And as we played on the last week's program, the thinking in Israel amongst the religious types is that coronavirus is a warning from God, a warning. This is the fist of God. That's what they always call it. And it is a warning. It's a punishment because of Donald Trump's plans of dividing up the land. Okay. Now, these things, yeah, folks, I mean, we dismiss these people just like they kicked the guy out of the restaurant on David Letterman's show for, you know, walking around without any clothes on when it was 20 degrees below zero. You know, we dismiss these things as the rantings of insane people, which they are. However, you know, we should not for a moment underestimate the power that these ideas have within brains such as those owned by very dangerous and powerful individuals such as Benjamin Netanyahu. And his network of spies and CNM and other people spread throughout the world, including in America. And I can't remember if I brought it up on last week's program or not, I republished a piece that I had published years ago dealing with Israel and her bioweapons program. And I took a section from Viktor Ostrovsky's book, The Other Side of Deception, where he talks about how there is a facility which Israel built out in the Negev desert, where they test these infectious diseases that they are working on Palestinians who they capture, because they want to test the disease, see how deadly it is, and of course, in order to come up with a vaccine that they can give to their own people to make sure that the Jews are safe from it. And I think that the case can be very authoritatively made that this is exactly what we're dealing with right now with Corona. Let's see, I'm trying to figure out, the video here with our rabbi. Actually, no, he's not a rabbi, he's just a professor. So the messianic hopes for the region is what Abramson says, that the destruction of the temple by the Romans effectively ended immediate messianic hope for the region. Okay, doesn't mean that it went away forever, folks, see, because not too long after the Jews were driven out of Israel, out of Judea. In their being scattered, they never gave up on it. That's why they came up with that saying that they when they would do it, but it was always a toast, you know, whether it was on Yom Kippur or whatever. They would say, next year in Jerusalem. Next year in Jerusalem, meaning we're going to come back and we're going to take Jerusalem and we're going to finish the work that was begun by our patriarchs and matriarchs, our founding fathers, and especially the Maccabees. Okay, so he then talks about, he talks about how the destruction of the temple had deep reverberations in the modern Jewish and Israeli mindset. Okay, so anybody who thinks that the destruction of the two temples, and especially the second one by the Romans that led to 2,000 years of them wandering around without a home, without a country, and all the persecution that reached its pinnacle with the quote-unquote Holocaust, and which they have commemorated every year for 2,000 years on the ninth day of the 11th month in the Hebrew calendar, Tisha B'Av. Dr. Abramson is very clear on this, that the destruction of the temple was left a permanent scar on the modern-day Jewish and Israeli mindset. Let's see. Okay, yeah, the last thing I want to talk about in reference to his little presentation. He relates this story, and you can read about it in two places. It's in Josephus's book, which I encourage all of you to read, entitled The Jewish Wars, where Vespasian, okay, he's the general who was originally sent by Nero to Judea in order to put down this this uprising. Vespasian, as they have, he began in the north near Syria and started working southward until they got to Jerusalem. So Vespasian has now begun the siege of Jerusalem. And, what happened is that the zealots, the modern day at that time, the modern day equivalent of the Maccabees, during the previous engagements, they're fighting amongst themselves and over who's going to be the top dog. And they burned all of their food reserves that would have lasted them for years, and water reserves that they didn't burn it, but they got rid of the food, and So this rabbi, Yohanan ben Zakkai, he sees the writing on the wall. He sees that the Jews stand no chance, that the Romans are just going to flatten the place. So he has his followers smuggle him out in a coffin. And then he meets with Vespasian and he says, please, you know, please give me a safe passage. You know, I don't want to be a part of this thing that I know is coming. Just please give me safe passage and one city, Yavne, and its sages. Well, as our professor here indicates, folks, this was the point at which modern Judaism, as we know it today, was born. Not that there was necessarily anything distinctly different from what Ben Zakkai was going to create, but rather, and this is very important, folks, had Vespasian not allowed that cancer cell to escape, the world as we know it today would be a completely different place. Completely different. And, of course, this is just a repeat, or hearkening back, I guess maybe we would want to call it, to the theme that we have discussed on previous programs, which is what if? What if? You know, we talked about the what if. If Jones, you know, Alex Jones and some of these other people who have created so much destruction to the what small accomplishments that we had made since 9/11 with the kooky stuff that they put out there for public consumption, and now you can see how all of that has worked out. You know, Jones, and that's the other thing. My friend Paulie, he reminded me the other day, he said, hey, listen, you know, you owe yourself a dime. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, on your last program, you said the word that you promised you weren't going to say. And if you did say it, you were going to find yourself a dime. You were going to have to put a dime in the piggy bank. And I said, oh my gosh, that's right. I forgot. I do owe myself a dime. Well, folks, you know, we can't avoid the discussion. So what I have elected to do is, because it does have to be discussed, all right, these people making up the, I'm not going to say the word, folks, because I don't have that many dimes to put into the piggy bank, okay? These people, we're going to call it the MVMT. You know how, you say like CIA is the Central Intelligence Committee, FBI is... the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the NKVD, I can't remember what it was in Russian, but you know, that was the KGB. So we're going to call it the MVMT, okay? And I think all of you know what that means. Or we'll just shorten it to the MT, okay? That way we can talk about it without saying that word, since in fact it does not really exist. What if? What if, you know, we were talking about the what ifs, if people had used their brains and had not allowed themselves to be the playthings of Judaic intrigue and intelligence operations. And yes, folks, that is exactly what that whole Sandy Hook nonsense was. Every bit as much as the Arab Spring nonsense was, it was a creature of Israeli intelligence aimed at propagandizing people in a certain way that they would be running around doing silly things and making the whole process fall apart. Sort of like the story in the Tower of Babel in the Old Testament. You know, it says, these people, they all got together and they started building this giant tower, which really was an accomplishment, you know, up into the sky. And then it says, you know, we decided to put them to stop them from this. So we confused their speech so that they couldn't communicate with each other. Well, this is the model that they use, folks, in destroying the things that we build. Okay, what little edifices we were able to build after 9/11 all came tumbling down as a result of these various things, including Sandy Hook. Anyway, as it as it applies to Vespasian's historic decision, history-making decision, disastrous decision, to allow this rabbi to escape. Okay, this is the equivalent of a person suffering from cancer, and the doctor who is, you know, cleaning the cancer out, you know, either through surgery or chemotherapy or homeopathy or whatever it is, and he stops short. Just one cancer cell survives. And look at the mess that we have today, folks. And I think that the importance of this is that we have to understand that when we are dealing with Judaism, when we're dealing with the religion of the Jews, this is exactly what we are, the kind of material that we are handling here. There's nothing good about it. It is a corrosive force. As our insane writer Rushkoff warns us, it's a corrosive force. It's like acid. Okay? And it can't be made into anything other than that. And so I find this very, very profound. I had run into it before, but I guess the importance of it just didn't signal with me at the time. But Vespasian's decision, based upon, you know, the fact that the Romans were very tolerant, and at that point, the decision still was, the protocol still was, we're not going to raise the city to the ground. We want to save Jerusalem, keep it there, you know, as a testimony to Roman strength, you know, that we were able to put down a rebellion without destroying everything. And that decision on the part of Vespasian to allow that one cancer cell to escape the judgment that would eventually fall upon that city is the reason that we find ourselves in the trouble that we're in today. Now, this may be a moot point, folks, because it is so late in the game, so late in the hour, and, you know, literally, the knife is at our throat, okay? But as I have said before, we don't know what's going to happen next. We don't know. And we have to, well, at least as far as my own personal involvement in this goes, I'm going to continue to do the you know, the deep historical work that has to go into this, because, you know, the Jews and their power over us, folks, the very first ingredient that they put into everything that they serve us is deception, confusion, so that we can't think straight and so we can't communicate with each other. Okay, so the only potion, or was that the word we would use? It would use like a snake bite. What is it that you give them? I know. So I'll figure it out after I'm done with this. The only remedy to this black magic that they utilize against us is the truth. Okay, let's see. Snake bite. Sorry, folks. This is, I'm just, my mind is not, you know, I was explaining this to my good friend Paulie the other day after we were talking about the dimes that I owe myself. You know, I spend a lot longer, and that's, I guess, bringing this thing full circle, folks. This is the reason why we're doing the program today, you know, instead of Sunday, because it's not that I wanted to see what was going to happen today with whether or not Pence was going to certify the votes for Biden, but rather because these things that I think about all the time, they really require a lot of deep concentration on my part, and I don't want to open my mouth and say something until the thought has formulated in my mind. The problem with that, of course, is that I am not as young as I was, and so I move a little bit slower, but a little bit more deliberately. And this is the reason why I can't. Antidote! Antidote! There it is! Antidote. The antidote for this poison for this cancer, the chemotherapy that we need to use in freeing ourselves of this Judaic intrigue and this by way of deception we shall make war, is the truth, folks, as Jesus Christ said. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. See, he's engaging in a little bit of prediction business himself. You know, not if you know the truth, then you might be set free, but you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. It's a very definitive and definite statement. Anyway, folks, we shall be back Sunday, God willing. Obviously, the world is going to be a much different and more interesting place by Sunday than it is now. And we'll figure out what it all means. We'll hang out. We will hang in there as long as we can, and we'll put it all together for you. So until we meet again, folks, stay safe, stay sharp, and we'll see you next time.